Blog Talk Radio.
It's a fine day here, not that you would know it by looking out. If that's your measure, you know, if you don't like the seasons, well, I don't know what to say to you. It's blowing hard, it's snowing, it's at a temperature that is brisk, minus 13 or 14 or 15. That's just the effect of the wind, mind you. But, you know, we don't tend to make too much of wind chill here in this big landscape. It's like it gets cold. It's like, what does it matter? Stick your nose out if it feels cold. Put on another layer of clothing, something warm on your feet. My goodness. Hello and welcome to this aspect of the adventure of masonry. I've been thinking more aware of the different metaphor that we just I don't know if it's proper to say that we take it for granted, but it's just ever present, and it's like our symbols in lodges. Tracing boards and what in a lot of places that I've been in this big province. I mean, yeah, it is great, huge, beautiful, but for the most sake, our creators, our developers here, the developers of the practice of masonry here, chose to. To distribute and ensure that lodges had certain artifacts, certain adornments that would distinguish that place as a lodge. Curious is that they're not talked about. For the most part, and I guess it's not too trying to be smug here. If I was to tell you that a lot of the symbols are unknown to fellows, I don't know if that would actually shock anybody. But when I say that, you know, we have this retreating, these symbols that that are on the walls, as if not, as if we don't take any of it literally. It all is a big, fanciful, multifaceted metaphor. But I think that it might be just underestimating the exercise of masonry. For example, it's only been in the past couple of months I've become increasingly aware of ashlars. Not that I haven't stumbled over them in lodges like you have, but realizing they are subtle. They don't scream. They're there. But their messaging is subtle, and particularly when I associate some human quality with the notion of rough and refined. And the eye opener was the ego and conscience. But I've had that, I think it's very similar when I look at, I'm sitting in the east looking at pillars and realizing that we have terrestrial and celestial. And we can go off on those explorations as they relate to us. It's the perspective is us looking out the porchway. It's us looking out the entrance of the temple. And what do we see? And what's around us? And what influences are impacting us? That's the curious part, because if we put any two people, if we move the people in that position, my goodness, what they notice would be different. Probably, unless we're a bit stiff about it and say, oh, when you stand out there, this is what you will see. Well, that's to me like staring at a dot on a wall without realizing that the dot was once a symbol of the great architect. No, just staring at that dot on the wall because we're going to ascribe a certain meaning to it. And when you see that dot, that's the meaning, that's the trigger. Well, I guess if I was a great hypnotist, I is that the lesson? Is that the command that I would be giving everybody around me? Hell no, absolutely not. Tell me, because I think it's just jaded. Go to that porchway, go to the porchway or entrance of the temple, look out. Now tell me, what do you see? What do you see around you? What thoughts race through your mind? And it's like my goodness, it's how to, we're so complex, we can't even begin to think about our besting our thinking. What we can do, the one is better than the other. We tend toward more qualified opinion, and for lots of us, most everybody, we're boys, remember, you are taught by the old dogs, the mentors. And the more acute your skills are, the more you're able to listen, and the more skillful the mentor is to realize the natural confusion and to do something with it, do something by explaining context and bridges. We come to different, would you say, plateaus of learning? We say those plateaus of learning are the emergence of awareness. I guess if we were very erudite and we were being very generous, we would. But day by day, we don't think of them like that. We think, oh my goodness, that was that was a lesson learned, then that becomes the work of our lives when we're little to learn. Until we find somebody that introduces us the feeling of joy and excitement, this pride in our ability to put ideas together. And for some, for many, I think the most, it's not necessarily personified. It may not be a personal relationship. It may be, for many of you, me, most of us, a relationship with the stories about greatness, about success, about courage in the face of danger, about people able to unravel the mysteries and puzzles and learning. For example, I'm particularly caught up for many, many years now in scientific discovery. I looked at the carpetbagging that went on about the ideas of Tesla. And then I felt a fondness toward this genius. I've never met the man, of course. But when I read about his exploits and his thinking, his contributions, it's stunning. It's just stunning. And the word genius comes to mind. And then to find that there were other people that stole his ideas, that exploited this man. I wish I could say I was shocked, but it's more, I'm not even disappointed anymore. It's more, it's an expectation. Now tell me, is that cynicism or is that honesty? Is that the truth? Well, I tend to think that people get, when people are exploited, here's the other truth. The world will know. Everyone will know. For everyone that tries to take advantage and exploit of the vulnerable, the world discovers. The world knows eventually. Because the truth prevails. Like it or not, truth prevails. It's with us all the time. So I don't think I would shudder if anybody was to suggest that that's a fear tactic. No. It is what it's like. It's like for me now, it's like mathematics. There's a clarity and a purity. I can respect what it does. It's like when I stand before, let's reveal some of the art that I enjoy. Let's say it's a Renoir. Okay. There's a beauty to it. I can see and experience the beauty. I don't know the brush stroke. I don't know the blending and grinding of color and the blending. I don't know that. I don't know that the draftsmanship, you know, it's just, and then the composition, the story that's being told. I don't know that, but I do. I see it, and it's an expression that I feel, and it has an incredible effect. It's like Bernini's columns in St. Paul's Cathedral. It's like, they're just enormous castings. It's gorgeous. So I'm spellbound like that. The artists out there, I'm captivated. It's another facet. It's the imagination. It's like, my goodness, look at what they were able to do. That's the kind of reasoning that I think masonry employs. Look at what it's able to do, and we'll talk about the path. But whether you start the trip and whether you prepare for the trip and whether you're striding on, whether you're, and then at any point, it's a fool's paradise. You're moving way too fast. How can you enjoy and smell the flowers? And how can you're moving too slow. You're procrastinating. There's always cynicism around us. But who knows that they're moving along in balance? Is that person moving along in balance? And how do we recognize them in the crowd? Well, you recognize them, and it only takes a few seconds to figure out that they are one of the fortunate few that have sought and found balance. You can seek it, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee I checked with my obligations. It doesn't, this stuff didn't come with a guarantee. Just here, have at it. And by the way, don't let us down. And we think you're intelligent enough to absorb this. And by the way, fingers crossed about whether you're going to work out. But have at it. And then, son of a gun, it's true. You just, it's like, I'm pushed across the River Styx, but I'm looking around for the guide, and he's still on the shore saying, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. You know, there's so much material here. Here, open up that cupboard. Look at what's inside there. That'll tell you everything that you need, surely. It's because I get to, have a sense that at a certain age, I ought to be showing my best foot. I ought to be showing I have patience. And that doesn't mean I just walk around with this little cloud in this bubble. It means that when I'm in line, I think of that beautiful metaphor, beautiful story. It came from China to teach yourself patience who wait in line at the elevator. And I thought, how beautiful, how beautiful. When I wait in line, I always have a book, something to read. Take your time. Be casual, be friendly ahead, go over whatever work you have to multiple times. My time is a joy because I'm just, instead of these things being interruptions, I consider them normal. That when people are around, I don't need machine-like efficiency. I like that encounter. It's gooey. It's the twist of a phrase, the smile, the gesture, and it is the grumpiness and impatience. And it's real life. And so if I'm sitting there tucking myself into Edward Rutherford's book on China, so be it. And yeah, I'm like you. I carry around material just for these occasions and, bring it around and keep it handy. And you're impatience? Like, why? It occurs to me that one of the beautiful lessons, experiences, is that you have more and more control of your own time. If that is, I won't say that's the characteristic of a rich man. That's the characteristic of a wise man. I'm going to end here with not with an act of contrition, no saying, oh my goodness, we've gone on too long. There is no too long when we're talking about, it's like how we measure time. So you can head for the door here's the boss droning on about something endlessly and look at the watch, let's get this over. Or how we apply time, how we apply Einstein's theory, it changes. Time changes when you're sitting on the swing on the porch on a beautiful night with a beautiful a beautiful companion beside you. It's like time just seems to, it just goes on and on. It's just, you lose track, don't you? Hmm? Yes, of course you do. And what's happened to time? So do I smile when somebody talks to me about efficiency? So I know that was those studies were out in the 20s, I think. Yeah. All those time efficiency, and they came back in the 70s and 80s, we're going to be more machine-like, and because we can drive more profit, blah, blah, blah. It didn't work. But, people back then had this feeling that if they had money and they had the responsibility and they were set on profit, that they could order people around and people were dependent. And so you could get them to do, that was the conversation that gave rise to What movement would we say? What revolt? The revolt of the slaves in Rome? Something like that. Or Greece? Or labor movement today? We don't call it slavery, do we? It's too impolite. We have a pretty good show today, I think. Pretty good is an understatement. We have a great show. And I introduce a poet from a period of history that most of us have, I don't know if we've visited, and if you have, great. Solon, the poetry of Solon the lawgiver, the Greek, the Athenian, the guy that predates. This is the guy born in 630 BC, and he died in 560. Now, just for a frame of reference, to give you an idea, and we'll get into it, his poetry is really, I think, well, interesting, about this legend, this noble guy. Socrates was born in 469. This guy was born in 630, okay, BC. Then Socrates, then Plato, 428, after Socrates, and then Aristotle, 384. So great minds, yeah? Great minds. And we'll talk, today I'm going to talk about the seven wise men of Greece, and then we'll get to the poetry. But first, don't you deserve a little bit of music? I think, I would hope, my gosh. Let's see. There's more technical wizardry here than you can just shake a stick at. Thank you. Holy mackerel. Beautiful. You can tell, confession time. I'm going to read a commentary today, but you can tell that I'm biased here. I'm going to reveal, another reveal. I know you love these things. I think we learn best when we're relaxed, especially the kind of material that masonry covers. We learn, I don't think we always like to admit it because it opens up so much. Oh my goodness, how can we possibly, life experience gets in the way. But when you think about it, being at your most relaxed and how you get there with some people, if I say that, find you that spot and become centered, I'm not going to tell you how you find that place. That would be impudent of me. I want you to, I'm asking you to find that spot so we can talk. Later on, as I was moving around my travels, I discovered a whole theory about windows, and I think it's particularly something that was refined in Japan, not too unusual. For the Japanese, a window of opportunity where children could learn and absorb so much information in a short period of time when that window opened. And then the Japanese, as they tend to do, being attentive, understood ways of enhancing that moment, of creating that anticipation. And so it what I came away with was a mindset and a looked, and certainly I began to see how experience and observation fit with that model. That when somebody's distracted, trying to teach them is what? Ridiculous. It's self-serving. You know, it's like human resources, it's like trying to force feed people with information for some purpose that has no bearing on what's happening in the room. It's just in and out. The usual question is, what is your intent? Do you expect people to retain information? But I think the question that I ask is, is it at all respectful how people learn and what they learn? So for us, I've simply tried to express what I know, what I see. I know from my observations around those windows. I don't push a window in front of people and throw it open and say, there, if it's there, you bloody well have to learn. No. It's relax. How have you been? What's new? Settle back. Can I get you anything? Would you take a bit of hospitality, or do you feel like it's, you know, you want to do that? Assume that for the occasion. Great. I'll absolutely love it. When we settle into the conversation, it usually happens gradually, doesn't it? It's not usually, sometimes, you know, when you're met with the enthusiasm, it's like, well, of course, we're going to just jump right into it just because that enthusiasm is infectious. Other times, it's like, settle. The lesson, believe it or not, is from my boyhood. When I was a little fellow, I was taken to a trout stream on one of the family farms on Prince Edward Island. Beautiful. Yeah, and it was just a gorgeous environment. It was in the evening, in the summertime. Everything was very lush around. And here I was, a little boy, and I was left with my fishing rod and some bait. And this was a trout stream. Yes. Not very wide, not very deep. Crystal clear water, you know, you can tell bubbling along, and then there were pools, and I was taught, don't be, by my grandfather, so marched on up to the shore, very enthusiastic, and threw myself down on my chest. You know, you don't want them to see you. If you do that, they'll do, it'll spook them, as he would say. So you crept up, you kept a low profile, all of that stealth. I would be, by goodness, maybe 9 years old. It's using stealth. And even to hear that they can hear you when you're walking up the shore. You can walk up to the edge of the stream. They can hear you, and they'll react to the sound. So what do you do? Nobody told me. They told me the situation, and all of a sudden my footsteps became softer. Even as an old man, it's still with me when I go near a stream and I'm fishing. It's lovely. Lesson learned. But it was that the sun sets, the little bugs are on the surface, the trout are coming up, and you can see them. It's like, where do you start? It's like, catching them is like just part of it, just seeing it and experiencing it. And then every so often you see this little flash. And yes, I did catch enough for breakfast for everybody the next day. Little lessons learned. You see, I think it stays with you when you're relaxed. So I try to do that here. A cup of coffee, a hot glass of tea, a glass of a single malt, a pint of Guinness, whatever, a glass of Merlot or Chardonnay, you know, Pinot Grigio. It's your taste, not mine, your taste. And then we get on with the conversation a bit. How are you? Recognition and merit fortunate or not, we are in the age of communication. We may feel alone in this, on this blue planet, the only elements with conscience, as far as we know. We might have a great deal in common if we took time to look. The communication links are spreading around us organically. It's a bit off-putting for those who now value their privacy and freedoms of their childhood that have been undone in a way over time, though at the time we felt constrained and hard done by. Masonry seems almost prescient in that regard. The inner man decides what gets through, what is or is not important in a given moment. With all the glitter and white noise, his question about primacy and purpose makes sense. As brethren have greater access to scholarship, we become more knowledgeable, and not only more, but we are applying what we know to Herculean challenges. And I say that in all humility to all the desktop scientists out there and desktop publishers. The laboratories have spread. This is an alchemist's dream. Yeah. And of course, we're all hunkered over our table, protective of our formula. When we are aware of the elements of a productive Mason, it's clear to us when we meet. First, we are looking for them. What is it that is a sign? It's that chemistry that we pick up in the first few seconds. I'm talking with a person. Is there a fit between you and I? I refer to that as intelligence because that's been, you know, sort of a vulnerability that was taught a long, long time ago. It's just, you know, keep up, always strive to do better. You're never quite there, but strive harder. Just, you know, you're raised by Stoics. The spirit of Masonry exists whether a man has been initiated or not. Being prudent, we know to exercise judgment with them. Incontinence, no, not that kind. Incontinence is a peculiar form of badness. And I'm quoting here. Unlike vice, incontinence does not involve willing bad behavior. Rather, it consists of knowing what is good, but lacking the self-control to do good. Incontinence is not as bad as vice, since it is partially involuntary. That's from the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. The lodge sharing these observations will be cultivating a different sort of compatibility. Intelligent people are revealed when observed. It's the details we appreciate in our deliberations. I never was much for people. Let me put this a different way. I never would claim that I've seen all different forms of expressions of intelligence, whatever that is. But I've seen unexpected discovery, and I've learned not to underestimate the human condition, never. Because as soon as I do that, I'm going to disappointing myself. People are genius. And so do I want to enhance the possibilities? Yeah. A long time ago, I learned the mechanics of it. I learned that, and this is terribly unpopular where I am right now in this nation state. it's terribly unpopular. But it's the truth. And, you know, truth doesn't necessarily wait for popularity, does it? We learned that a good diet and exercise, stability, particularly stable housing, were indicators of where would facilitate and encourage balanced mental health and focus, increase the ability of a child to concentrate, to learn. We know that, and so being in a place of tremendous affluence, I think that's the science. But the value, I think, is about compassion, empathy particularly. So if we look into, and I've developed a fascination for this, looking into the, I call them dirty little secrets just because it sounds more dramatic. I'm always pleased when assumptions are challenged. And I'm one of those people that has, I think it's been progressive, like doing things that aren't progressive, but telling ourselves that they are because we're doing them, you know, nice teleological advantage, magical thinking. Not in a good way. And not in a good way. But enough of that right now. We could go on at length, and we should. My gosh, we should. I'm inclined to just need to top up what I'm sipping here. And here, I'll be right back. Thank you. My goodness. Life is hard, isn't it? Let's sit back a little bit. I want to talk at you and talk about these a little bit of perspective on us. I'm no longer sure that I don't necessarily need to be remembered in life. But it didn't. It's been something that's been on my mind for a long time, and then I just stumble, like most things, I stumble across, you know, phrases or research or, you know, legends or stories that confirm it. This is one of them. This is I was listening to a lecture on this fellow, Solon, the lawgiver. And I thought, and when I found out that he was a poet, I thought, my goodness, we have to share this with on the program, because I'm always looking for poetry that reveals. I know poetry is not quite like prose. Poetry heightens the meaning. It makes certain ideas very special. And I like that, almost like an archetype, you know, it's to just stop and to be able to hold something out in your hand and examine it from different angles. And I know it's always moving, but it's like a snapshot. And just for a description, and then we can move on. We never really stop, do we? Solon, let me share with you a little bit about this fellow. He was, and just for a little context, he is considered one of the seven sages of ancient Greece. I had no idea. This is what happens with men of significance. It's like they become what, trivia for a 21st century person like me. My goodness, they left a wisdom, and they had impact in the ancient world. They were a collective of influential philosophers and lawmakers, and they were very active in the Greek archaic period. That's 5th to 6th century BC, and it is likely that the concept of the seven sages was first developed in ancient Mesopotamia, where they were called the Apkula, a group that existed before the Great Deluge. So think all that diluvian approach to thinking. The seven sages were revered for their practical wisdom. Now, hear this. I know a lot of you will embrace this. And some of it has survived to this very day. Think of the maxims: nothing in excess, and know thyself. There. Throughout ancient history, the seven were noted by the likes of Herodotus and Plato and numerous other, Diogenes, Laertius, and there was a dispute about who should be a sage. more than 23 names were put forward at one time or another, different versions of the list of seven. But four of the seven persist in almost every version. So we'll work with that. Eh? Thales of Miletus, Solon of Athens, Pittacus of Mytilene, and Bias of Priene. And the remaining three are usually Chilton of Sparta, Chobulus of Lindos, and Periander of Corinth. So, yeah. No, the interesting thing, there's a little bit of a hint, but this is a stretch, Masonic stretch, my goodness. But the latter three were often taken out because they were considered tyrants. Now, tyrants in the day wasn't the same as the way it's used today. This had more to do with leadership. But their reputations are why they were often switched out for more pleasant figures, such as Anarchistus, Myson of Chinea, or Pythagoras. more pleasant. Now, if you read a little bit about Pythagoras, you can see there's strong opinions about all of these people that what this wasn't just a public relations exercise. So the introduction of the seven stages marked a turning point in ancient Greece culture and identity. And it illustrates a point where stories about ancient heroes, such as Odysseus and Achilles, no longer seem convincing or meaningful to members of the political assembly. And so academics like Plato and Herodotus turned to new heroes, plucked from fairly recent past. You don't like, you're ignoring the old heroes and their themes? Okay, let's see if we can come up with something a little more contemporary. And they were far enough away in history to be reinvented as semi-mythical, yet they were recent enough to be grounded in contemporary thought. Nice, that, you know, Goldilocks zone, eh? And so the seven stages became a new way of introducing practical and abstract wisdom through maxims that, while maintaining Homer's traditional oral narrative form. I can't begin to talk to you about, you know, I want to get off on talking about the masonry being an oral culture that is paying a significant price adjusting to becoming a visual or a written culture. But I won't. In Solon's lifetime, Greeks had not yet begun to write history or biography. It wasn't until the 5th century that accounts of his life and works began to be put together. And on the evidence of his poems, which there are 300 or so lines preserved, his law code and oral tradition and inference from existing institutions, we put together to better understand this fellow. He was born a noble, but moderate means. And as the tradition states in his travels and economic measures suggest, he may have been a merchant. And he first became prominent around 600 BC when the Athenians were disheartened by ill success in the war with Megara for possession of the island of Salamis. Now, remember, these were warring nation states. Eh? By publicly reciting a poem that made the issue a matter of national honor and that called on the Athenians to rise and come to Salamis to win that fair island and undo our shame, Solon introduced them to resume the war, which they eventually won. The early 6th century was a troubled time for the Athenians in other ways as well. Society was dominated by an aristocracy of birth who owned the best land, monopolized the government, and were themselves split into rival factions. Now, little lesson. History may be giving us a window into our own future here. The poorer farmers were easily driven into debt by them and were unable to pay, so they lived in reduced conditions. Serfs, and in extreme cases, sold into slavery because of the debt. The immediate classes, and that, take a look around and you can find parallels, can't you? The intermediate classes, middling farmers and craftsmen and merchants, resented their exclusion from the government. We see that around us now. These social and economic and political evils might well have culminated in a revolution and subsequent tyranny, as they had in other Greek states, had it not been for Solon, to whom Athenians of all classes turned in the hope of a generally satisfactory solution to their problems. Because he believed in moderation and in an ordered society in which each class had its proper place and function, his solution was not revolution, but reform. Now, think about the news around us. We can't oppose our will and say, settle down. Don't be screaming. Don't be screaming, a little girl or little man. Don't be screaming. Tell us what's concerning you. The rage we have to tune it out because it's a distraction. We're really, we really need to focus on the content of what you're what your concerns are based on. Yep. So who would do that? Us, apparently. Here. This is the poem that I've selected. It's called The Man Whose Riches Satisfy His Greed. Now, I'm not talking about the trap that the more you go after, the more need you have never satisfies need. So that argument is out the window. And I see that we have a capacity these days. We're able to generate wealth, but we really are falling behind on the distribution of it. But we're working on it. Listen to this. The man whose riches satisfy his greed is not more rich for all those heaps and hoards than some poor man who has enough to feed and clothe his corpse with such as God affords. I have no use for men who steal and cheat. The fruit of evil poisons those who eat. Some wicked men are rich, some good men poor. But I would rather trust in what's secure. Our virtue sticks with us and makes us strong. But money changes owners all day long. The man who is greedy for money is no wealthier for that than a poor man with only enough food and clothes for his body. I have no use for men who steal and cheat. Those who buy into this become greedy. Some bad men are rich, some good men poor. But trust only that what I know is forever. We always have our virtue, and it makes us strong. But money makes people change constantly. We have these ideal images in our minds, you know, the conditions that are most favorable to us, most that, you know, that weather, that sunrise that's just right. And for the past 20 years or so, I've been enjoying myself with this notion of a perfect day. And because I didn't know what that was for the longest time. I knew what perfect meant, but could I have a perfect day? And I thought, well, life is not a dress rehearsal, and I'd like to. And I began to experience, with that mindset, I began to experience days when, for whatever reason, I just had this sense of things in balance and just perfect, whether it was the cappuccino that I was sipping, sitting outside reading and enjoying a late breakfast, you know, those kind of moments where the music was just exquisite, repartee, some banter between me and my wife, or, you know, at the chess game, I have perennial chess game. I just feel I'm so terrible at it. I can't, at least I tell myself that. And you know, those days when it just, it worked, those perfect days. So this comes from the way that perfection occurs is knowing the opposite, imperfection. And it's like, to know light, we know darkness. So keep that in mind. The period in history we're talking about, it happened a long, long time ago. What bearing could it possibly have on us? Well, it does, I think. It's about quarrels, about quarreling between lodges and inside lodges. And that, I've talked with you at different times. We've talked about that. The tensions, not that they ever override the depth of reasoning, the foundations of masonry, never do, but it's the actual condition of the lodge that some men, as is normal, you know, on that big spectrum, some make consistently bad decisions, and some learn from them, and some improve, and some don't. So, and, you know, a thing that, why does bad mistakes and stupidity seem so easy? Why? You know, like, where do I get that notion that striving and develop some understanding of virtue and living that life is supposed to be hard? I would have thought it would be the other way. And so it should be borne in mind that we were talking about deep social divisions and the quarreling that came out. We know this was not unique to Strasbourg. My goodness. We find the pattern repeated over and over again elsewhere. I can attest to that. In Toulouse in the 1780s, two lodges quarreled, again bitterly, because men of high station in one lodge appeared in their Masonic regalia at a ball, thus in the eyes of their critics exposing the order to public derision. In Limoges, lodges experienced internal crisis, which their historian has once again related to issues of class and estate. Another historian who has worked extensively on urban culture and sociability in the west of France found barely a city where there were local lodges were not at one moment or another racked by an often virulent polemic. And who likes a virulent polemic? Meanwhile, the quarreling in Strasbourg was so extreme that the lodge in Lyon, hardly a sanctuary itself, described the Alsatian disputes as political enterprises and outrageous excesses. What emerges from the evidence provided by the French lodges in Strasbourg and elsewhere is the picture of a society riddled by social tensions and hatreds that were more pronounced and visible than what can be seen in the other Western European societies, to which the microcosm of the Masonic Lodge has provided an entree. The records in Strasbourg permit us to relate Masonic feuding more concretely than has been done before to the larger society, or more precisely, to the tensions between and among the three estates. The press, the church, the ruler. Le Candeur left a splendid set of records, almost as detailed in some years as what we have from the Amsterdam Lodge Le Bien Ami. The French records offer no support for the image that the lodges were consciously attempting to create democratic forms. Nothing could have been further from the interests of the Strasbourg lodges, nor should we see them as mirroring a hegemonic ideology from which one dissented at one's peril. That interpretation, as noted in the introduction, has been offered by a few present-day historians, and by contrast, we are about to witness dissension around almost every conceivable issue. Oh, well, how is that? I thought that's what we were witnessing today. Bloody hell. Somebody's taking credit for that? They did it before? Yeah. What to learn, eh? What can we learn from this? We can learn to rise above it, I think, that it's not news. It is what it is. It's not news. But is it a personal, would you feel personally challenged by this? By the pettiness? I don't know. I really don't know if I would. I'd like to think I wouldn't. Thank you. Does it get any better than that? It's time, gentlemen. Madame. Thank you for tuning in. It's been interesting today. When you see the conflicts around, it's a measure of our success. We never attempt to remove them, but to understand them and to minimize the effect that they have on us. And I think generally we're pretty effective in doing that. I hope you'll come back. I don't think I've finished trying to convince the world that masonry does have relevance. Still, it's a wonderful vehicle for ideas and profound ideas at that. Thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing you again in a week. Thank you, and a call out. I hope you're all well in the United States and in Brazil, in Japan, in to listeners in Russia, South Africa, Greece, and the United Kingdom. Yes, certainly. I'm grateful. And in Canada, I have. It's not gratitude. It's something different. Acknowledgement, maybe. See you all soon. Thank you.